Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Networks with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on Klusterman v. Metropolitan Hospital featuring Kevin Wynoski. Kevin is counsel at Clement & Murphy, where he focuses on briefing complex legal issues at all levels of the federal court system. Previously, he served as a trial attorney in the Department of Justice's Civil Division, where he briefed and argued high-profile cases challenging federal laws as well as executive branch policies and decisions. Our moderator today is Kayla Toney. Kayla's counsel is for First Liberty Institute, concentrating on religious liberty matters and First Amendment rights for clients of all faiths. Prior to joining First Liberty, Kayla litigated religious freedom cases as a constitutional law fellow at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. She clerked for Judge Gregory Maggs on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces before that. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you, Kayla, for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you all today. We get to talk about an exciting case, Klusterman v. Metropolitan Hospital. We represent a wonderful Christian healthcare professional, Valerie Klusterman, who has been a physician assistant for 2 decades now. She works in her local community clinic for 17 years, and this was actually the same hospital system that her mom and her grandma had also worked in Western Michigan. So very much a dedicated member of the community, and some of her patients were even second generation. So they brought their children to see her once they were grown up. And Valerie served patients of all different backgrounds. She had great relationships with her patients and continues to in her new role. And because of her strong Christian faith, she could not affirm certain statements about gender that went against her beliefs. And so this issue came up back in 2021 when her employer, the University of Michigan, started requiring some equity, diversity, and diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings. And at first, the trainings were simply just informative about, how to serve different patient populations. But then the training started to include a quiz, a required affirmation, where you had to make statements such as gender is fluid. And the only way to finish the quiz and, complete these mandatory trainings was to say that, yes, it is. And this was something that conflicted not just with her Christian religious beliefs, but also with her medical judgment as a medical provider. It's very important to know the biological sex of your patients to make sure that they're able to get the specific treatments and care just the details of their treatment to make sure that that's correct. And so she was concerned about this. And so she simply asked a question to her DEI coordinator, asking, if it was possible for her to not finish this training or if there was, any other option. Truly what she did is requested a religious accommodation in order to, not have to affirm statements that went against her faith and her medical judgment. And instead of receiving that accommodation, which would have been very easy to provide, the hospital officials called her into a meeting and attacked her faith. They called her evil and a liar. They were very hostile, and they accused her of things that were not even relevant to her experience. They accused her of not wanting to serve certain patient populations, even though that wasn't the case. And they also asked, if she would be willing to refer patients for gender transitions. And this was never something that had come up. This is very much a hypothetical dispute at this point. But when she explained that her faith and her religious beliefs, you know, really would prevent her involvement in those procedures or referrals, they attacked her again and told her not to bring her Bible to work with her. And so just a couple weeks later, she was fired. And she sued in federal court, represented by First Liberty. And we brought several claims. We brought Title VII claims because of the failure to accommodate and also just because of the religious discrimination to terminate her because of her religious beliefs. And then we also brought constitutional claims under Section 1983. And so we brought free speech, free exercise, and equal protection claims. And I'll just mention the free exercise claim briefly because that's the most relevant. Relevant one for this conversation. We explained that the hospital was very willing to accommodate other providers. So for example, a provider who wasn't comfortable examining patients of the opposite gender, or a provider who didn't want to prescribe opioids, they were accommodated because another provider would just do those examinations or make those prescriptions. And it was never a problem. It was simply a matter of scheduling. And so the fact that the hospital refused to accommodate Valerie and instead terminated her was a free exercise violation. So we filed back in fall of 2022, bringing all these claims, and the hospital filed two very long motions to dismiss on many different grounds, ranging from focusing on the individual defendants that we had sued and then also on the hospital itself. And so we litigated back and forth for 13 months. In total. And near the end of that time, we received a favorable ruling on the motions to dismiss. So essentially, Judge Beckering in the Western District of Michigan allowed our core claims to proceed. She did dismiss the free speech claim, but she upheld the free exercise and the Title VII claims. And equal protection as well, I believe. And so, so that was a favorable ruling. And she seemed to view the facts, you know, in a similar light to the way that we had pleaded them, which was the burden that she had at that particular stage of the litigation. But shortly after we received that ruling, we received a surprise motion to compel arbitration. And the reason this was so surprising was that we were having discussions with opposing counsel about our discovery plan. We had just had a call earlier that day, sort of talking about the schedule and the plan for next steps. And so we were all ready to go into discovery. And then here comes this motion to compel arbitration. And the court actually granted it. And so that's when we appealed. And that's when Clement and Murphy, an amazing national firm, joined us. And Kevin Wynoski came on board to handle the appeal at the Sixth Circuit. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Kevin, to talk about the appeal.
Well, I will start the same way you did, which is, of course, thank you to FedSoc for having us. Thanks for everybody for taking time out of your afternoon to join us. And thanks to Kayla, not only for moderating and giving us that primer, but also for bringing the case to Clement Murphy and thinking of us for it. As she was going through the facts, I was reminded of sort of why it was such a great case. And a big part of that is Valerie herself. Not only is she a wonderful person with a wonderful family who I got to know through the process, but she sort of did everything that you could possibly have wanted a plaintiff in her position to do, right? She sort of requested all the meetings with the right people. She, you know, always sort of led with kindness and thoughtfulness. It was, you know, the easiest fact section to write. And as Kayla just pointed out, the fact that they, that the hospital was talking about plans for discovery and having a 26F conference the very same day they moved to compel arbitration, made the fact section even easier to write. But when we got the appeal, I started digging into the issues. It was pretty easy for me to tell at the beginning that we were sort of likely to win. I was fairly confident in our ability based on the precedent, both from the Sixth Circuit and really across the country, talking about how once you've litigated in district court for several months, once you filed dispositive motions, you've given up your right to arbitrate. But it was easier to sort of tell that we were going to win than to explain why, although there's a ton of precedent That precedent is not always precise in whether it's relying on federal law, and if it's federal law, if it's relying on the Federal Arbitration Act, the FAA, or some maybe common law source, or some maybe judge-made claim processing rule. There are some opinions that suggest state law might have a role. Of course, anytime you're in the arbitration context, one of the follow-up questions is, who gets to decide this? Is it going to be the court or the arbitrator? So we had lots of precedent on our side, but that precedent was at some points conflicting, or at some points, you know, to borrow a word from the academy, maybe a little under-theorized. So that led to some of the hardest conversations during briefing with Kayla about sort of how to frame the issue up. It always struck me and for the other appellate lawyers on the call that this was really an issue of forfeiture, that we didn't know, you know, and it didn't really matter whether the hospital did this intentionally. So once you've gotten to the 13-month point, once you've gone through two full rounds of motion to dismiss briefing, it's too late to assert a right to arbitration. Although it naturally felt like forfeiture to me, the cases almost uniformly talk about it in terms of waiver. And so that added another layer of complexity or ambiguity to exactly the right analytical framework to apply, which is part of the reason why, and this is not to skip ahead, but ultimately the rationale the panel went with, we focused mostly on the text of the FAA, which uses the language in default in section three, which says, in section three and four, of course, one section deals with moving to stay a case pending arbitration. The other one involves moving to compel arbitration. The Supreme Court has said you interpret the two together. The in default language appears in section three, and reading it together with section four, the upshot is that if you're in default of your agreement to arbitrate, you can't move to compel arbitration. So we sort of seized on that language, both looking at dictionaries from the 1920s and 1930s around the time of the FAA's enactment, looking at early cases from the 30s and 40s, which we thought were ultimately very helpful in the in default language. And although I continue to think, and Judge Murphy in his concurrence also continues to think, that this most neatly maps on what we would think of as a federal common law forfeiture rule, the panel and ultimately, you know, certainly our brief supported the notion that the case was properly decided under the text of the FAA and the in default language from section three. So, you know, that sort of was probably the hardest decision in terms of how to brief the case, or at least this particular issue in the case. Once we got our panel assignment, which happened, I think, 2 weeks before the argument itself, which was back in February, I was certainly heartened, but maybe a little bit fearful to see Judge Murphy on the panel, only because he had written a number of opinions on this forfeiture versus waiver distinction. We also had Judge Davis and Judge Blumkatz on the panel. And when we got to the oral argument itself, which was actually not held in the Sixth Circuit Courthouse, it was a roadshow at the University of Cincinnati, which was another element of fun. You know, oral argument for me was a real illustration of the principle that judges are going to ask about what they're most concerned about. And you got to meet them where they are and respond to them. And if you have the time left over to make your points, great, but to use their questions as a signal, because all of their questions for the entire 15 minutes I talked were about this distinction between forfeiture and waiver. So again, after the argument, I felt pretty good that if that was the thing that was troubling them, if that was the thing they were concerned about, that spoke well for a reversal. But in terms of the precise logic, text of the FAA, federal common law, state law, you know, we certainly had a theory for why we won under all of those buckets. And then, as I mentioned, the panel opinion sort of took that first bucket and ruled under the text of the FAA. It is the first, or at least sort of the cleanest, federal appellate decision, certainly in the last 20 years, to decide an arbitration waiver slash forfeiture case on these grounds. It is also a case, certainly if you practice in the Sixth Circuit, in the wake of Morgan versus Sundance, which is a Supreme Court case from, I think, 2021 or 2022, that dealt with a very similar issue and removed the requirement of prejudice. Before Morgan versus Sundance, you assessed arbitration waiver by looking first to the conduct of the litigant, and then secondly as to whether the plaintiff was prejudiced by the defendant's failure to compel arbitration. And so Morgan versus Sundance changed that long-standing rule in a way that unsettled precedent in a number of circuits. And Klusterman represented the Sixth Circuit's opportunity to say that first prong, looking to whether or not the defendant has acted inconsistent with their right to arbitration, still remains good law, even though Morgan removed the prejudice requirement. So in that respect, the opinion, in addition to the clarity it provides in the text of the FAA, provides additional clarity on the longstanding federal common law rule that continues to apply in the Sixth Circuit and every other circuit, and applies both in religious liberty cases like this one, but really employment cases from all across the spectrum. That was the majority opinion. Judge Murphy's concurrence was sort of music to my ears, and that it picked up on the theory that we laid out in our briefing, which was this really all sort of maps onto a federal common law forfeiture standard. And he explains the difference between forfeiture as a federal law rule in the arbitration context versus waiver as a state law rule looking to the source of the right, which here would have been under Michigan contract law. Judge Blumkatz wrote a separate concurrence, so we had a majority and two concurrences, suggesting that the distinction between forfeiture and waiver was more complicated than that, and certainly more complicated on a transubstantive level looking outside the arbitration context. So that's a little bit about the three opinions in the case and certainly the panel and how the argument went. But the most important headline is that we won and we got a precedential opinion clearing up an area of law that had left a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty, both since Morgan versus Sundance, but even before. And now if you find yourself in the position of representing a plaintiff against a defendant that has litigated in court before moving to compel arbitration, you certainly have a case to cite that gives you some support under the text of the FAA that the defendant is in default of their right to arbitrate.
Thanks, Kevin. Before we go to Q&A, and by the way, there's a Q&A feature down at the bottom of your Zoom screen where you can type in questions. So please feel free to type those in because that'll make this even more of an interactive discussion. It might be interesting to touch just briefly on some of our other arguments because waiver slash forfeiture was our main focus in the appeal, but we had a lot of other arguments as well that we considered. And the one I'll mention, and really this also goes to the impact and importance of this case, is that arbitration is just not the right forum for constitutional rights disputes. It might be the right forum for strictly workplace matters, matters involving income, benefits, those sorts of things, because the primary remedy is monetary. But for cases involving constitutional rights like this one, it's, you know, money is involved potentially, but it's not the key remedy. And there's no ability to seek injunctive relief or any of the other sort of remedies that constitutional claims bring. And there's also not the precedent setting value that is very important in cases like this, where especially on this particular issue that's controversial right now, a lot of religious healthcare providers are concerned about, you know, being forced to participate in procedures that violate their conscience. And so I think the ability and really Valerie's commitment to wanting to help and wanting to set a precedent so that this doesn't keep happening to similar people of faith, I think is just significant. But I'm curious, Kevin, for your thoughts on, you know, kind of the strategy behind which arguments to highlight the most and then which that we sort of included, but maybe didn't keep front and center.
Yeah, so I think this particular argument, Kayla, that you're referencing turned out to be Roman II of the brief. The panel didn't reach it. I'm secretly happy that I didn't get too many questions about an oral argument because I do think it is a much more difficult issue, in part because another impact of Morgan versus Sundance. So before Morgan versus Sundance, there's tons of Supreme Court and lower court opinions saying things along the lines of arbitration clauses are due special solicitude. We, you know, are going to strictly enforce arbitration clauses, perhaps even more strictly than we would enforce other contractual clauses or other contractual rights. Morgan versus Sundance sort of walks that back and says, no, we didn't really mean that. What we meant was arbitration clauses are due the same weight as any other contractual right, no more, no less, right? Before the FAA, before 1925, you had lower courts frequently discarding arbitration clauses or reading them to have somehow less force than other clauses in the contract. The FAA was passed to correct that, and that's consistent with the role it plays today. So Morgan versus Sundance clears that up. When it comes to applying arbitration to the context of a constitutional right or a constitutional dispute, there's still a lot of pre-Morgan precedent talking about how if the parties have agreed to arbitrate, that's a binding agreement and it'll be sent to arbitration no matter what. You know, everyone on this call knows that arbitration clauses are notoriously binding, hard to get out of, and that's good and bad, you know, for clients on both sides of the spectrum. You know, it's good in the sense that arbitration has traditionally been thought of as a way to achieve a faster, cheaper, more informal resolution of claims. To Kayla's point, it's sort of an odd fit when you think about classic constitutional and certainly classic impact litigation, where you're really looking for precedent. Monetary damages are not the sort of relief you're seeking. And because of that, there are certainly, you know, lines of precedent suggesting that if you are a plaintiff for constitutional claims and you've agreed to arbitrate, you probably need to uphold that agreement, but you're probably not bound by it, you're probably able to then, if you're not happy with the result you get in arbitration, to return to court, which was sort of a separate argument we made that also reinforced our primary argument, which was, of course, if you stop all this now and you send the plaintiff to arbitration after having already spent 13 months in district court, there's really nothing that's going to stop us all coming back to district court here in another 6, 8, 12 months once that arbitration concludes, which sort of illustrated how silly it was after 13 months to then, or would have been, I should say, to allow the hospital to go to arbitration. So it was always nice when you can make a backup argument that is both good and mutually reinforcing with your first argument, which was certainly the way we sort of pitched it. So still an unsettled area of law, definitely less precedent on that point than there was on our first waiver / forfeiture point. I still think, you know, probably the right answer is if you've agreed to arbitrate, you're going to have to do that, but you can always return to court and seek separate relief or different relief to vindicate your constitutional rights. Luckily, we didn't have to get that in this case, but I'm sure it's a live issue that will return.
Exactly. Well, one other thing I'll mention just real quick before we go to the Q&A is we had some great amicus briefs in this case. We had 7, which was a really strong showing of support, and we're very grateful for those. And I think they helped to demonstrate the importance of the case to the Sixth Circuit. I think it would have been easy to look at it very narrowly. And I think that the briefs from a variety of perspectives helped the court to see the underlying importance of the case. And also it was a nice opportunity for those additional arguments that, you know, maybe weren't our primary argument or weren't our primary focus to still be made. So just a thank you to the amici. The states of Kansas and Nebraska filed for us, the Manhattan Institute, Religious Freedom Institute, Christian Medical and Dental Association, Catholic Medical Association, and a group of similar organizations, some arbitration experts who weighed in, and then the Foundation for Moral Law. So if any of you are on the call, thank you. And I do think it's a good reminder that for, you know, these types of cases, amicus briefs can really make a difference, especially when they're from a diverse group of people and organizations, just helping the court to see things from different angles.
I'll certainly echo Kayla's thanks, especially to the extent anybody who contributed to those briefs is on the call. I also have to give a word of thanks to Kayla and her team at First Liberty, because they really were the ones who did such an exemplary job to help assemble such a wonderful coalition. And I'll just tell a funny anecdote about the amicus briefs, which is maybe more in the vein of a practice point or a practice tip. The other side, I think, probably surprised to see seven green briefs on the top side, ended up filing a motion to strike them, which is, of course, a curious strategy because it ensures the panel is going to read them. But they did file a motion to strike them. That motion was denied. And of course, the panel had to read them to deny that motion and presumably read them again during the consideration of the merits. So they were both helpful. And this is one of the rare cases where we can guarantee they were read.
Absolutely. Well, let's turn to Q&A. We have some good questions in the chat, and feel free to add more if folks have more. The first one, how could a pro-arbitration ruling be immediately appealable as opposed to a non-final interlocutory order? That is a great question. I actually went back and double-checked the record on this one, and the hospital's motion to arbitrate was styled as a motion for summary judgment, which was odd because we hadn't done any discovery, and usually you save a motion for summary judgment until after discovery. But because they styled it that way and because the court dismissed the case, it was a final order. And so we were able to appeal it right away. And now we're actually heading back into discovery at the district court, and we anticipate that we'll have another round of actual summary judgment motions once discovery is concluded.
Yeah, there's certainly, you know, Sparizzi from, I think it was last term, might be two terms ago, from the Supreme Court addresses this point. So that's worth looking at if you're addressing a similar issue in one of your cases. It was sort of a nice style point for us that they filed their motion captioned as a motion for summary judgment, because it let me make the point that if you're using the word summary judgment, you're too late. That is probably not the way they should have styled their motion. They should have styled it under Section 4 of the FAA, and the Judge Murphy's opinion talks a little bit about that. But because of that, and because of the district court dismissing the case, both sides, the plaintiff and the defendant, asked for dismissal, not a stay. So that's how we winded up being in the Sixth Circuit.
Next question, did the defendants move for arbitration in an attempt to avoid precedent here? More broadly, is there a bright line in the litigation process in which arbitration is no longer available under this holding?
Yeah, so I can address that. As to the first part of your question, I don't think they, you know, I don't really know, but I doubt they moved to arbitrate solely to avoid precedent. There is a lot of great precedent, including a Seventh Circuit opinion that says defendants can't play heads I win, tails you lose when it comes to arbitration. They can't wait to see how a case is going on the merits. And then only after they've taken that first bite of the apple or the first swing of the pinata and realized it's not going their way, can they switch horses and take the case into arbitration. And that sort of is a nice segue to the second part of your question, which is, you know, it's always going to be case specific where that line is. But once a defendant has gotten a, you know, pretty conclusive signal from the district court about how the merits are coming out, that's generally where courts, both in the Sixth Circuit and around the country, draw the line. And there is a helpful discussion in Judge Murphy's majority opinion. The Sixth Circuit has always phrased it as a totality of the circumstances test. There's no sort of one single bright line factor that you can point to. I had tried to draw out, and the majority opinion, I think, supports this view that if you filed a 12B6 motion to dismiss, seeking a total and complete victory, that line appears in some of the opinions, seeking a total and complete victory on the merits, that's definitely a bright line, surefire indicator of, you know, forfeiture slash waiver. The opinion talks about how just a motion to dismiss might not be that indicator, because sometimes a motion to dismiss is on 12B1 standing grounds, and that's a little different. Sometimes if there's a mixture of claims that are arbitrable and claims that are non-arbitrable, that might be a reason why a motion to dismiss, if it's only going to the non-arbitrable claims, might not have the same effect. But I do think, you know, to answer the thrust of your second question, if you look at the opinion in the Sixth Circuit, if you file a 12B6 motion seeking a total complete victory on the merits, I don't know how you could then credibly switch to arbitration under this opinion.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that, Kevin? I remember when we were researching all the different cases on this issue. Some of the cases seem to focus really heavily on the timing. So they would say, well, 6 months went by and that's too long, or only 3 months went by and that wasn't long enough. And then other cases focused on the actions of the other side. So, for example, did they start discovery? Did they take depositions? Did they file discovery requests? Or, you know, again, the types of motions that the other side filed. So I'm curious, based on your read of the opinion that we got, do you think that the timing is more significant or the actions that are taken by the party trying to assert arbitration?
Yeah, I think totally the actions. I mean, 13 months was a great number for us, because if you looked at the precedent, there were, like, you know, the 6 month range, sometimes it's forfeited, sometimes it's not, 8 months. But once you got sort of above a year, I'm not sure that I found any opinion that said it wasn't waived or forfeited at that point. So the 13 month was a nice grace note to send there. But even the courts that focus more on months are using that as a proxy for actions. And especially given the way modern district court litigation works and how slow some courts are in the backlog in some courts, I think it's always going to be more persuasive and certainly more consistent with this opinion to focus on actions. But to your point, once you've started discovery, once you've gotten through that dispositive motion seeking a total complete victory on the merits, you know, those are the right things to emphasize. If there's just been some early threshold litigation, personal jurisdiction or something like that, might be a little bit harder. But some discovery and 12B6 motions are all pretty good indicators that a district court has started to engage with the merits and the time to move to arbitration is done.
Okay. Another question for us. Was this more of a bilateral arbitration agreement, or was it more of a unilaterally imposed employer policy? And this is, I think, an interesting question, because it gets to this idea of whether there's truly consent or truly an understanding of what someone is signing. I think most of us, when we sign contracts of various kinds, we might not even read the fine print or know what an arbitration agreement is or what it means. So I'm curious just kind of your thoughts on that. I'm not sure it was dispositive here because it was a valid agreement that was signed. But if you have any thoughts about sort of the ability to consent or just
and it certainly comes up in the cases. And, you know, Kayla, to your credit, you certainly litigated it very well and very ably in the district court. It's a tough as a matter of fact, here in this case, it was sort of what you would think of as a typical contract of adhesion, as, you know, presented an employer presenting a contract to an employee. That's a form, it's a line for you to sign it. You know, it's not the sort of thing that you're having your own counsel look over and negotiate and go back and forth on, you know, maybe anything but the top line salary number. So in that respect, it's a very typical boilerplate employment contract that, you know, you see both in the healthcare context and in the non-healthcare context in the Sixth Circuit and across the country. As to whether that makes a legal difference, there are certainly ways to try and argue that it should. Those things tend to take you down the road of an unconscionability argument, which is generally a state law argument and is generally not an easy one to make for plaintiffs. So that's part of the reason we didn't press it on appeal. And I think, you know, I don't have any regrets about that. I think keeping the focus on this was a valid agreement and 13 months is just too long was the right way to pitch it.
Right. Agreed. Here's a fun question. Do you think there was something in discovery they were trying to hide? The answer is yes. There's always something in discovery that everyone is trying to hide. We'll find out, because, like I said, we're about to start discovery. I mean, the reality is discovery is long and difficult and expensive for everyone. And so my guess is that this was largely a decision of convenience for the hospital, that they wanted to dispose of the case without having to go through all of that, and probably without the public exposure that comes from, you know, high impact litigation like this. One interesting point that I'll note, which is not connected to our case, but I think shows the shift even in the culture that has happened since Valerie lost her job and sued, is that the University of Michigan has stopped performing gender transitions on minors under the age of 19. And this is in response to investigations and subpoenas and pressure from various agencies of the federal government unrelated to our case. And so we think that's very interesting. interesting, just in terms of the timing that became public just a few months ago. And of course, the university still needs to accommodate religious healthcare providers because there's always going to be certain procedures that do violate the conscience of healthcare providers. And they do still perform gender transition treatments on adults. And so it's definitely important for us and for, you know, providers like Valerie to continue to pursue that ability to be accommodated and to have their constitutional rights respected. But I do think it's just interesting that timing and the change in policy that that has happened since we started this case many years ago. A question for you, Kevin. What about having an affirmative defense denied pretrial? Would that work a waiver?
Classically, it depends on what the affirmative defense is and how thoroughly you litigated it. I mean, the word we used as often as I could defensibly do so in the opinions was that this was a vigorous motions practice in our case. They were sort of zealously filing motions to the point where at one point, Kayla's team filed a motion for leave to amend. I think I'm getting this right. At one point, they sought leave to file a reply that they were not otherwise entitled to. So they both filed a motion to file a reply, and then they filed the reply itself. So like these people were not shy about writing briefs and throwing in motions on every conceivable issue. If, you know, to sort of put on the defense hat and say, if I was counsel for a defendant and wanted to make a threshold procedural issue that was not related to the merits, and I was careful about the way in doing so, both in terms of approach and also in terms of substance, saying that you know, there's certainly opinions from the Seventh Circuit and the Eighth Circuit that come to mind, and there might be several others that, you know, you can't just reserve your arbitration right and then do whatever you want. If you file a substantive 12B6 motion and you drop a footnote saying we all reserve the right to arbitrate, the court's not going to take that seriously, nor probably should they. But if you were to come in with a very limited threshold jurisdictional issue that was not tied to the merits at all, such that the court's resolution of it didn't give you a window into what they were thinking on the merits, I think that's going to be an instance where that level of preliminary litigation probably doesn't work a forfeiture waiver. The more of a window you're getting into the court's view on the merits, the more you start landing in forfeiture land.
Okay, that's very helpful. And I think that answered our next question, which was about what about Rule 12 motions that are not necessarily based on the merits. So something focused on personal jurisdiction, for example.
Yeah, 12B1, you know, those are all like a little better, but if you file multiple of those or multiple rounds, I think then you're going to start to stretch the credibility.
Right. That makes sense. What about the issue of knowledge? Because in this case, it seemed like the hospital didn't know about the arbitration agreement or possibly didn't think of it or recognize it because they just waited so long to bring it up. And yet at the same time, the hospital wrote the arbitration agreement. And so, of course, they knew or should have known. So can you speak a little bit to that issue of knowledge? And could there be a situation where a party legitimately did not know about the existence of an arbitration agreement? And would that somehow help them to avoid a waiver or a forfeiture?
Yeah, and I think this gets to the heart of why, to me, it always appeared more as a forfeiture than a waiver. When you're in waiver land, knowledge matters. When you're in forfeiture land, it doesn't. And sure, you know, the University of Michigan is a huge organization. They've got lots of lawyers, lots of litigation. It's certainly possible that these litigants knew nothing about the arbitration clause until finally getting ready for discovery, pulling the contract and reading it. And, you know, maybe that would mean they didn't waive the arbitration right. Except, Kayla, to your point, when the hospitals drafted the agreement, there's constructive knowledge there. So I'm not really sure that works, but it's certainly better for them But I still think from a forfeiture perspective, it doesn't help. And that's part of the reason why I think it's right to analyze it under a forfeiture rule. It's going to be really hard if a defendant comes in and says, look, we just didn't know about it, or I'm just the attorney. My client didn't tell me about this. It's going to be hard to test that and to tell whether or not they're telling the truth and what they knew and when they knew it, which is why you've got to assess it under an objective forfeiture standard that isn't going to turn on particularized notions of subjective knowledge.
Do you think that this opinion will have an impact outside of the narrow context of arbitration?
The best place to look for the answer to that would be Judge Murphy's concurrence. He wrote both the majority and the concurrence. I think he thinks it does. And he, you know, I think I said this already. One of the reasons I was both excited and fearful to have him on the panel was he had written so much about this and thought so deeply about this issue. And his concurrence certainly underscores that, that both in the arbitration context and outside the arbitration context, one of the ways to distinguish between forfeiture and waiver is to look at the source of the right and trace that back to the substance of the law the right comes from. I think he probably views it as applying outside the arbitration context. And I think the thrust of Judge Blomkamp's concurrence is, you know, not so fast. And, you know, as to what a majority of the Sixth Circuit will do and as to what other circuits will do, I think it's difficult to tell. But certainly the intuition of, to the last point we discussed, forfeiture being no knowledge and waiver being knowledge, I think, you know, this confirms that that intuition applies alive and well in the arbitration context, which was not totally clear in advance, given how all of the opinions almost uniformly use the word waiver.
Would you say that there's a circuit split on this issue, or did the Sixth Circuit sort of fall into line with all of the other circuits? And I guess that could be kind of a broad question. So let's focus it since Morgan. Do you think there's a circuit split since Morgan versus Sundance about how the waiver law is supposed to apply? Or do all the cases kind of point in the same direction?
I think all the cases point in the same direction. And certainly one of the notes we sounded in the briefing was if the Sixth Circuit had affirmed, it would have opened a circuit split and taken the losing side of it. But I do think, although not all of the opinions have been as precise about the distinction between waiver and forfeiture as this one, and certainly not all opinions have addressed it in terms of the text of the FAA, I think the thrust of all the opinions is once you filed a dispositive motion seeking a ruling on the merits, and once you combine that with the passage of a not insignificant period of time, you've given up your right to arbitrate, whether under the FAA, a forfeiture standard, a waiver standard.
Okay, that's helpful. If I remember right, Justice Kagan in Morgan v. Sundance called it waiver or forfeiture or what have you, which I thought was just a great way of putting it.
Yeah, I think she threw estoppel in there too. I mean, that was a case that also my firm litigated, and it was one that, you know, in the Supreme Court, these issues were more fleshed out and got a little bit more play than they did in the Eighth Circuit. And, you know, Morgan is a wonderful opinion by Justice Kagan that reserves a lot of those issues and resolves the case on the, you know, narrowest grounds of whether the prejudice inquiry was a proper lens to assess the waiver or forfeiture or estoppel or what have you question. And I think that ambiguity that Morgan recognized but left open is a big part of this case and this opinion and why we were able to prevail.
When you read the concurrences, you mentioned that Judge Murphy wrote both the panel opinion and a concurrence, which is always fun. And then there was an additional concurrence from one of the other judges. Do you think they signal that there will be more doctrinal refinement in this circuit? And does that impact how you think about arbitration timing in future cases?
It's sort of hard to see exactly how that doctrinal development will play out because, you know, to your point about a circuit split, these issues are analytically interesting and they made it difficult for us on the front end to precisely explain why we win, but they didn't change, you know, a result that I was always pretty confident in, which was that we were going to win. And so when you have an issue that's not really outcome determinative, It's difficult for me to see, you know, a court going en banc to resolve this. I think also as the fact that you have two concurrences, which are, you know, fairly rare when the author of one of the concurrences is also the author of the majority, suggests that a lot of these things can come down to intuitions about forfeiture or waiver, or the proper role that state law should play in the analysis, that are both complicated and can be idiosyncratic. So I think this was a huge step forward, and I think reorienting things around the text of the FAA is certainly the right direction to go in other circuits if this issue comes up, because that's something that doesn't turn on intuition, or at least isn't supposed to. But, you know, as to some of the more complicated questions, I think we'll probably continue to see some concurrences, some law review articles, all sort of hashing that out.
Yes, we welcome the law review articles. And it's interesting you mentioned the text, because I do think this is at its heart a textualist opinion. It essentially says there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of intuitions and sort of different ways that courts have handled these situations, because it does very much depend on the specific facts and the timing and all of that. But I think at its heart, to go back to the text of the FAA, which talks about default, I think that's really helpful. And that's at least encouraging for me as a textualist to see that, you know, judges truly are trying to get the law right here. They were careful about it. And ultimately coming back to the text can sort of anchor us so that we have more predictability, which I do think there's value in.
It's sort of an obvious practice point, especially on a federal society talk. But if you've got text that's relevant, even if it's old text, even if there's not a lot of recent opinions addressing it, lead with it or make it your second argument, because I think the panel, you could see sort of an oral argument, they were struggling to, you know, piece some of the precedent together, and this gave them a really nice hook to latch onto, and is ultimately the direction the majority opinion took. So that choice was ultimately a fruitful one for us, as it is in almost every case.
Agreed. And that's something that really struck me at the oral argument, was that the judges were truly searching for guidance. And one of them actually asked you, you know, tell us what to call this and how do we think about this case? And I just thought that was, you know, powerful, that they truly did want guidance, and you gave it in a very helpful way. And I think, you know, going back to that text, it really does anchor the judges and it helps them. And that's part of our role as advocates. We fight for our clients. We fight for what's right in each case. And we're able to help judges to create better opinions that better align with the law. And that's, you know, that's a really fulfilling goal when it happens. One more question here. If a plaintiff who has an arbitration agreement files a lawsuit instead, are they at risk of a breach of contract counterclaim?
I guess. I don't know that I've really thought about it. The problem that immediately jumps out to me would be what the damages would be in that situation, especially if it's a contract that doesn't have a liquidated damages clause or something like that. I think it's much more likely, and given the overwhelming thrust of the dynamic in this case, in these cases, that an employer is going to be wanting to avoid the burdens and expense of federal court litigation. They're going to avoid the burdens and expense of discovery, that rather than seeking to bring more litigation, because of course, if you're counterclaiming, you know, you sort of think that the primary claim coming at you is valid. That rather than invite that litigation and invite discovery, they would move to get to arbitration as quickly as possible. That's at least what they should. And of course, when they don't, and when they wait 13 months, and when they get a view of how the court thinks about the merits, and only then do they seek to arbitrate, whether they knew about it or not. I think the answer before this case was pretty clear, but now it's crystal clear that they've forfeited the right to arbitration.
Well, I think we've covered all of the questions in the chat, so feel free to send more if members of the audience have them. But I guess I'll just ask kind of one closing question for you, Kevin. Are there any big takeaways that you've learned from litigating this case, and especially from doing the oral argument?
We've addressed some of them already, you know, in terms of briefing. Lead with the text. Be clear, especially if you're in an appellate court, about the difference between forfeiture and waiver. Even if the law isn't clear, you know, I was always pretty clear on what I thought it should be. And I think that helped frame the way I thought about the case, the way I briefed the case, the way I argued the case, and the panel largely picked up on that. When it comes to oral argument itself, once I found out about the panel and found out it was Judge Murphy, I certainly went back through and reread all of his forfeiture / waiver opinions and was ready to talk about them, which I think sort of moved the ball down the field a little bit. And the more broader takeaway, I would say, this case was a wonderful opportunity for us to get involved with First Liberty and to team up with great lawyers. And we certainly learned from Kayla and her team and the way they litigated this in district court, the way they brought it to us. It was also just a wonderful opportunity to get to know a client and a person like Valerie, her husband, her kids. We all had dinner the night before the argument. And it was a very concrete reminder for those of us that work in the private sector and are representing companies and entities that are not always a real person to connect you back to a real person who's been through a multi-year saga trying to vindicate her constitutional rights and religious liberty, and to be able to secure a tangible and positive outcome for her was the most meaningful thing of all. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to have done it. I'm grateful for Kayla and her team for having the trust in us at Clement Murphy to do it. And hopefully it won't be the last time we get to work together.
Well, I know it won't be, and I appreciate you saying that. That's very kind. And I guess that's just something to mention for folks who might be interested in these types of cases. At First Liberty, our entire model is built off of amazing volunteer attorneys like Kevin. And so the reason we're able to take so many cases, and we try to win all of them when we can, obviously, it's not always up to us, but the reason we're able to take them and to help these wonderful clients is that we have attorneys who donate their time, who work at private firms, probably like many of you, and are willing to do cases with us pro bono. And we try to do a lot of the heavy lifting to set up the case for you, but we definitely try to give you the most exciting opportunities. Like Kevin here was able to do the oral argument and did a great job. So if you haven't worked with us, it's certainly a great opportunity. We're always looking for new volunteer attorneys. And if there's an area, that you have expertise in, that can be very valuable. One of the reasons we reached out to Clement and Murphy is that we knew they were experts on the arbitration issue because they had just litigated Morgan v. Sundance in the Supreme Court. And so that was incredibly helpful to have their team's deep bench of experience. We've got a few minutes left, and I had a couple more questions come in, so we'll just hit those really quick. Any read on the trial court's reaction to having its arbitration order quashed?
That's one for you.
Yeah, that's a tough one. We don't know yet because we haven't officially started discovery. So we might get a sense of that as we have scheduling calls and that sort of thing. But a note of hope, at least for us, is that before the trial court ruled to send it to arbitration, they did rule for us on the motions to dismiss. And so we think that's at least encouraging that they read the facts in the light most favorable to Valerie as they were supposed to and seemed relatively favorable. So I think, hopefully there's not hard feelings there about being quashed, especially since this was more of a procedural issue, as opposed to, I think it can be difficult when you get a merits ruling overturned and then you have to go back to that court. That can be a little bit awkward, but we'll see how it goes.
It is sort of a curious feature that, the district judge had written a pretty long and pretty complicated and pretty involved opinion of the motion dismissed that let most of the claims and certainly the court claims proceed to discovery. So, I guess it's possible that she felt like her hands were tied on the motion to compel arbitration, the motion for summary judgment. And it's possible, at least conceivable to me, that she might be happy to see y'all back, but you'll find that out sooner than me.
That's right. That's right. I certainly hope so. And then is there any chance of a cert petition? I believe the deadline for that would be 90 days after the opinion. So technically we could still see one come in, but I would be surprised since the hospital has wanted to avoid litigation. It seems like a cert petition would just prolong everything. What do you think, Kevin?
I agree. That's a question for the hospital. I don't see a circuit split here to a point we already discussed. If they file a cert petition, we'll see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we had another question about the free speech claims. So this is an interesting one, and it might come up again now that we'll be back in the district court. I think the main reason that the district court dismissed our free speech claim originally was that there wasn't a specific situation where, or at least from the court's reading of things, there wasn't a specific situation where Valerie was forced to use pronouns that she that conflicted with biology. And that was the basis of our claim, was that the hospital told her, you have to use pronouns that are, you know, preferred, regardless of what you think about it and regardless of your faith. But that didn't actually happen in the sense that they fired her in the same breath. So we think it's, you know, a perfectly strong compelled speech claim, because the issue of pronouns has been litigated a lot, especially since we filed. There's been many rulings saying that you can't actually compel people to speak names or pronouns or messages that go against their beliefs. I think that's becoming more and more settled as an area of First Amendment law. But I think this particular case was just an interesting timing, because in the same breath as they told her she would have to use preferred pronouns, they also fired her. So there wasn't necessarily a chance for that to play out. But it certainly might come up again in the future. And I think as a matter of policy, it's an important thing to watch for in these types of cases, because, of course, employers can have policies about, you know, how their employees interact with each other. But at the same time, they can't force employees to say things that go against their conscience. And that's where having something like a religious accommodation can be a really great live and let live solution. And that's what Title VII allows for. That's why we sued under Title VII, because it allows for employers to make their workplace rules and govern, you know, their business in the way that they need to. But when they're able to accommodate religion without there being a substantial increased cost on their business, they have to do it. They're required by law. And the Supreme Court has made that clear as well. So I think that's the beauty of religious accommodations, is that it truly is a live and let live solution in the employment space. And there are a lot of great cases on the compelled speech issue. We've got another one in California right now called SE versus Gray, which is about students and whether students can be forced to speak messages about gender that go against their faith. And we got a win on a preliminary injunction, and then that's up on appeal now as well in the Ninth Circuit. So definitely an issue to watch. And I think in the healthcare space, it's especially important because, like I mentioned earlier, there's the religious belief aspect of, you know, healthcare providers that don't want to be forced to say things that go against their faith. But there's also a medical aspect that's very significant, because if a provider doesn't know the biological sex of their patient, they might prescribe the wrong dose of a medicine, or they might miss an important cancer screening, for example. And so it is definitely an issue that further litigation is needed. And since we're going back to the district court, we will be trying to get to a ruling on the merits on these types of issues, because we think that they're important for many other healthcare providers right now. Kevin, do you want to take our last question? Is there any partisan left-right tilt in the judges' opinions on this issue, or is it entirely politically neutral?
I think it's entirely politically neutral. You know, Judge Murphy, Judge Blumkatz, Judge Davis, I think probably typify the full spectrum of the Sixth Circuit. And they all agreed on the textual basis that formed the holding of the majority opinion. And the disagreement between Judge Murphy and Judge Blumkatz on the what really do we call this and how broadly does it apply is, I think, perfectly nonpartisan. So this was really a case, I think, where the judges were presented with a difficult legal question and did their best to get to the right answer.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us. Thanks for the great questions and the great discussion. We really appreciate your interest. And thank you to Margo and to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. We really appreciate it. I'll turn it back over to you, Margo.
Well, absolutely. And thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.